Hi guys, it's Dr. Sadaf, and I would love for you to like and share this podcast and make sure you leave me a review. I'd love those 5 stars. So please, when you send me a review, please make sure to put the 5 stars in and to share the episode with somebody that you know that could really use it. And I would absolutely appreciate it. Also, if you're looking to schedule an appointment with me, make sure you go to my email and put your name on the email list. You will be the first to know when I open up my office in spring of 2024. It's drsadaf.com. And last but definitely not the least, September 16th to the 23rd, 2024, I will be hosting a retreat with Dr. Basma Ferris in Morocco. You will be getting yoga and coaching, and we'll be doing excursions and cooking and spa and hammam and all of that great stuff along with meditation. So make sure you don't miss out. Spots are limited. So go to the link in my bio in both Instagram and TikTok to make sure you register. Enjoy the show. I am an American board certified OBGYN, a mom, a Muslim, and I'm talking about sex. This is the Muslim Sex Podcast. Welcome to the Muslim Sex Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Sadaf Lodi, and this episode is everything you need to know about sexually transmitted infections and intimacy thereafter and how to prevent those infections from spreading to others. Before we get started, the first thing I want to make very clear is that I am not giving any type of medical information. So if you're having any issues with your health, specifically any type of infections that you think you may have, please speak and see your healthcare provider. I'm not giving any type of religious advice. If you have any questions about your religion, please speak with your friendly neighborhood religious leader. And this is the Muslim Sex Podcast because I just happen to be a Muslim woman that talks about sex. So welcome, welcome. Today, I'm so happy to have on with me Dr. Charu Ramaprasad. Dr. Ramaprasad comes to us from the Bay Area. Welcome, Dr. Ramaprasad.
Thank you. I am so excited to be here and such a fan of the work that you're doing.
Oh, thank you. And we are so happy to have you on. So please tell the viewers and the audience and whoever's listening a little bit about yourself and what you do, and then we'll just get right into it.
Okay, great. So I'm an infectious diseases physician. I practice in the Bay Area, Santa Cruz, California. I do a lot of different things. Infectious disease doctors were pretty popular during the pandemic for COVID reasons. But my other big passion is sexual health from the lens or the framework of the infectious disease doctor. So I think a lot of different physicians have a lens onto sexual health. But my big interests are HIV prevention. I take care of a lot of patients living with HIV, and then STI or sexually transmitted infection prevention. And I really I'm interested in how we ease the path for patients who may be concerned about infection or wanting to protect themselves from getting an infection, how we ease the path for them to get the information and then the knowledge that they need from their physician or their other healthcare provider so they can feel safe and so that we can keep them safe.
That's fantastic. I love that. So, you know, I know you just mentioned HIV and HIV prevention. So let's start with that. I'd love to hear, you know, as an OBGYN, we screen all of our pregnant patients, all of our pregnant moms for HIV in the beginning of their pregnancy and then toward the end in the third trimester again. And, you know, we had actually most recently I delivered a patient that had HIV, and she was on, is it called a heart therapy? And she, you know, we had to make sure that her HIV count was really low and it was less than 20. And also, you know, about the baby and spreading that infection to the fetus and things like that. So yes, I'd love to hear more about it.
Absolutely. So I was gonna start by talking about HIV prevention, sure, but yeah. Actually, I'll take a step back from that and maybe talk about patients living with HIV for just a moment, because I love that you shared that case as an example. In the United States, have a recommendation that every person between the ages of 13 and 65 gets at least one lifetime HIV test. Women who bear children often will have more than one test because we test during every pregnancy. And the point that I think I wanted to drive home with the story you just shared is that certainly we work in the ID space and also in the primary care space to prevent HIV infection. And at the same time, it's also really important to know that people living with HIV can, there are highly active, highly effective treatments available, and there have been for years. And so we can achieve, as you suggested, an undetectable viral load or a below quantifiable level viral load. And I too have had several patients who have had children over the years, and through a combination of treating mom and treating baby after delivery and doing some very specific things during the delivery, moms who are living with HIV can, as if they're engaged in medical care through the duration of their pregnancy, have healthy babies who don't have HIV. And so I think that's a great example, actually, of how far the field of HIV care has come. And so then if we back up a little bit from there and talk about HIV prevention, that's really a passion of mine. So I, as I said, I work in Northern California. And in my previous job, I, along with a team of really amazing physicians and nurses and pharmacists and health educators, worked to set up a sexual health program. And one of the goals of that program was, as I said earlier, to kind of ease the way into HIV and STI preventive care and treatment. So what does HIV prevention consist of? For your audience, who I would guess are both patients and healthcare workers, HIV prevention in the field of HIV prevention has come a really long way. So there is something called PrEP, which stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis. And PrEP is really available to adolescents and adults, anyone who weighs over 35 kilograms and who is at increased risk for getting HIV or acquiring HIV. And we can talk a little bit about those risk factors if you would like, but it's, I think the things to know are that it is highly effective. So when taken correctly, over 99% effective at preventing the transmission of HIV, which is pretty remarkable for any medication in terms of its effectiveness.
Right, absolutely. You know, I think that that is really important information to know for, especially for people that are sexually active, and for them to know and understand that there is treatment available. And if they have been exposed, that there is treatment. But this is pre-exposure. This is before.
Yes. Yes. So you make a great point. We sort of, I should really divide up the way I talk about this in terms of pre-exposure.
Right.
And then post-exposure prophylaxis, and then sort of the treatment of patients living with HIV. And so I said earlier, we have highly effective treatments for patients living with HIV. I'll go all the way to the other end, prevention. And so pre-exposure prophylaxis means that you take a medication before you are exposed to HIV or the HIV virus, to prevent the virus from taking hold in your body. And so there are two ways to accomplish that. The first is with an oral medication. There are actually two oral medications that can be used. And more recently, an injectable medication has become available for patients who may struggle with taking pills or struggle with being adherent to pills. If you are a person, you are listening, and you are a person who thinks you might be at increased risk for getting HIV, some of those things that might put you at increased risk are inconsistent or lack of use of condoms during sexual activity, a known bacterial sexually transmitted infection within the last 6 months. So if you as a patient have had a known infection, gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis, or if you have a partner or partners who may be living with HIV or who are at high risk themselves for getting HIV. Mm-hmm. And so if any of those categories sound like you, that would be a topic to raise with your physician or your other healthcare provider. And on the kind of physician or healthcare provider end, we really say that there is a broad spectrum of types of healthcare providers who can prescribe a PrEP. And so infectious diseases doctors like myself certainly do. But there are a lot of people working in the internal medicine and primary care spaces, family medicine, OBGYN, who are also prescribers of PrEP. Because what it really takes is sort of a close relationship with your patient and the ability to take a detailed and what I like to say, shame-free sexual history. So if I'm seeing a patient who's interested in PrEP or who states they're interested in PrEP, there are a couple of things we do. We do some baseline laboratory testing. We test for HIV because we have to make sure someone doesn't have HIV before we start them on preventive medications. We test for viral hepatitis, hepatitis B, and often hepatitis C. And we do some basic liver and kidney and cholesterol measurements. And then depending on a few factors, including some of the lab work results and some of the risk factors for HIV acquisition, we may offer one of the two pills. One is called Truvada, and one is called Descovy. Those are the brand names. And then the injectable is called Cabotegravir. So that is that's kind of a brief overview. And we also, of course, check for baseline sexually transmitted infections. I could talk about PrEP forever and get really into the nitty gritty. So I'm going to pause for a moment and see if that feels helpful or if there are other things you think your audience might want to know.
I think that's pretty good with PrEP. I want to definitely talk about other,
absolutely, topics as
well. So I think that is fantastic about PrEP. I think that's good.
Perfect.
I'd love to start talking about a few other things. So, sure. So when patients come to me as an OBGYN and they say they want to be tested for sexually transmitted infections, and that happens a lot. I'll have a lot of young women come in that are sexually active, and they'll ask to be tested. And typically, the panel that we run for them is one of gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis, HIV, hepatitis. And those are typically the big ones that we run. Are there others that you would recommend for us to be running on these women? And then, and of course we do herpes, although I don't like to do herpes. And of course we always
talk a little bit about that.
We always screen for HPV through, the Pap smear, based on the ACOG guidelines. But I personally don't like to screen for herpes because I feel like almost everyone has been exposed to herpes at some point or another in their life. And it just causes more trouble than it's worth when you test for it, because patients get like really upset. They're like, oh my God, I have a herpes and, my partner didn't tell me and then blah, blah. And, I have to like kind of calm them down a little bit and just explain to them that, unless they've only had one partner their whole life and their partner's only had one person their whole life, that they could have been exposed at any point in their, sexual history, and that it's not really, doesn't have to mean that it's with the person that they're currently with. And the same thing happens with HPV. People get really upset because they think that it's their partner that gave it to them, and you know, it's really tough. What I always tell people is that when they are with somebody sexually, that they're not just with them, they're with everyone else that person has slept with, because in case they have been exposed to herpes, then they can, you know, potentially also expose them, and also same thing with HPV. So, you know, I'm curious to hear what you think.
I love talking about herpes screening, and I love talking about STI screening. So I'm going to talk about STI screening first. So yes. I agree completely with the panel that you do, obviously, and those are kind of the guidelines for testing and for screening. The one thing I would add is that there are women and men, and you probably see less men in your practice than I do.
No men. I'm a gynecologist.
So for the folks who are listening who see men as well, the other thing that I would consider offering is both oral and rectal gonorrhea and chlamydia testing. Mm. So we know that that pharyngeal gonorrhea is certainly detectable with testing, and important to test for and to treat to decrease transmission. Similarly, rectal gonorrhea and chlamydia are both important to detect. It's important to screen if possible. And the way I usually do that in my practice, where again, I see both men and women, is I usually just say, you know, if you use either your mouth or your bottom or your mouth or your rectum for intercourse, then I'd like to screen those two sites as well for gonorrhea and chlamydia. And people are usually quite receptive to that. And then depending on where they get their labs done, sometimes the healthcare practitioner has to do the swab and sometimes they can self-swab. But those are important sites, if relevant in terms of how someone has sex, to test as well. So that's one thing that I will offer in my clinic also.
Okay. Good
to know. And then in terms of herpes testing, I'm guessing you do the blood test. These are patients who don't have like a sore or a lesion.
Correct.
Is that right?
Yeah. Okay. So they just want, you know, they just come in and they say, I just want to be tested for everything.
Yes. You know? Yes.
So then they're tested for everything, and then they're usually upset with the results.
Yes. Yes. So you're absolutely right. So most adults will be seropositive or test positive on the blood test for herpes simplex virus 2, which is what I'm guessing people are often upset about. Yes. And I think it's an understandable desire to be tested because people want to know what's in their body or what they've been exposed to. I think the situation that becomes really tricky, at least for me, is when patients have never had an outbreak of herpes simplex virus 2. So they've never had any genital lesions or genital sores, but then they have a blood test that's positive. And there have been many articles written about this. I won't review all of them for your audience today, but the challenge is that the interpretation of that positive result depends a little bit on the pretest probability of that patient having herpes simplex virus too. So there is a false positivity rate to almost every test, including serologic tests. And so what I usually tell patients is we can test you for HSV2 if you want us to in the blood, but if you've never had an outbreak, I want you to think about what you're going to do with that information before we do this test, because depending on the type of person you are, you may or may not feel compelled to act on that information. But it's a very difficult clinical place to be in, and it's a difficult place for patients to be
I love that you ask the patient, what are you going to do with this information?
Yeah.
You know, I think that a lot of times, I can only speak from the experience I have with my patients, is that they will totally freak out. They'll be like, oh
yes,
my God,
it's very,
you know,
alarming.
I got this, and you know, where did I get it from? How long have I had it? What if I, you know, and it just... And then you have to just really, you know, calm them down and, you know, and say the things that I would normally say to help them feel a little bit better. And, you know, and then of course I say that if you ever have an outbreak, you know, where you have these blisters and, you know, water-filled sores in your genital area, then, you know, give us a call, we'll give you medication. And also, you know, I have to remind them that it's, you know, when they have an outbreak, definitely not to be sexually active, but that, yes, you know, genital can become oral and oral can become genital. And, you know, there is some shedding of the virus, even if it's not active, yes, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely right. And I think that's one of the hardest things for patients who have had an HSV2 outbreak in the past, is they want to know how to not experience pain and discomfort themselves, but they also want to know how to protect their current or future partners. And I think that's exactly where what you were saying, patients can approach their healthcare providers or their physicians about either being on episodic treatment, so treatment just when they get outbreaks, or being on suppressive treatment. And that's something that I think probably is underutilized a little bit in this country. And so that's something that people can sort of, if they've had more than a certain number of outbreaks every year, can certainly go on with that sort of desire to protect their partners if their partners are negative.
Right. Yeah, I definitely, I mean, you know, I give those options to my patients as well, if they would want to be on suppressive so that they just don't. And of course, it decreases the risk of transmission to their partner.
Absolutely.
When they
Absolutely.
Don't have a lesion or an outbreak. You know what I find interesting now is that there's been an increase in the amount of individuals with syphilis.
Yes.
So that is on the rise.
Yes.
So any ideas of why that is?
You know, there are probably a couple different reasons. And I, when I was preparing for this, I feel like we were meant to meet. But you know, the rise of syphilis is in conjunction with actually the rise of a lot of other STIs over the last 5 to 6 years. I would imagine in your practice, you have been concerned about, or maybe even seen also this, this concurrent or concomitant rise in congenital syphilis that we're seeing throughout the United States.
Yeah. So, you know, as you probably know, we test all our pregnant women for syphilis in the beginning, in the first trimester, and toward the end. And actually, most recently, yes, I did have the same patient that had HIV also had syphilis. And it was a new disease. I mean, because we had tested her in the first trimester, we had those labs. And then in the third trimester is when she came up positive for the syphilis. And she had received her two injections, and she, just the day that she received her third injection was the day that we had to deliver her for another medical reason. And so the baby never received that benefit of the third dose. Mm-hmm. And so the neonatologist told us that he would need to treat the baby once it was born.
We are definitely seeing a rise in congenital syphilis, sometimes in women who just haven't been tested for syphilis if they've not been able to get prenatal care, and sometimes in women who acquire syphilis infection between that first and third trimester when they're tested again. And then we're seeing, as you alluded to, a rise in syphilis overall. And I think it's likely multifactorial. We are seeing it concomitant with a rise in syphilis and other STIs. At times, we see that travels with or flows with certain other substance use disorders. And so as we see a rise in some of those substance use disorders, some public health departments refer to that as a syndemic. So we have these two kind of epidemics going on at the same time. And because there are some risk behaviors that may overlap, we believe that at least that's part of what's contributing to the rise in syphilis cases and in other bacterial STI cases over the last several years.
Wow. Yeah, I think that I've noticed that we didn't have as many cases, I feel like, just even 10 years ago. And I feel that most recently, there's definitely been an increase. I want people that, you know, maybe listening or watching this episode to know that there is definitely hope and there is a lot of treatments that we have for a lot of the sexually transmitted infections. In fact, I can't think of too many infections that don't have any treatment. What would you say?
Absolutely. Yes. The bottom line is that all STIs can be managed, and there is absolutely no reason for shame and no reason for kind of a loss of hope. And so I'll run through them quickly.
Yes,
gonorrhea and chlamydia are probably the two of the most common STIs we see.
Yes.
Both are treatable, and I think curable is probably the important thing for people to hear. So chlamydia is usually treated with the medication called doxycycline. It's pills, and there are some exceptions to that if people can't take doxycycline for certain medical conditions or if they're pregnant. But the treatment is highly effective. Gonorrhea is usually treated with a single shot of an antibiotic called ceftriaxone. And again, I think, as you say, treatable and curable. Syphilis.
Before you go on, I think that just one thing that I want to add really quick to that about the gonorrhea and chlamydia, the reason why a person should be tested and treated is that if undiagnosed gonorrhea and chlamydia infections can lead to infertility later on in life. And specifically with the tubes, with the fallopian tubes. And so that's why it's really important if you're sexually active and you have, you know, different partners, that you get tested at least yearly, I would say, wouldn't you say? That way, if you have an infection, and that those are one of the infections that need to be reported to the Department of Health as well. But if you are sexually active, you should definitely, you know, with different partners and such, or if you're at high risk, like Dr. Ramaprasad had mentioned, the people that are at higher risk for sexually transmitted infections, that you go and get treated, tested. And then if you have it, definitely treated. If you have been exposed to those two infections. So sorry, go ahead.
Absolutely.
I to make
my no, that's so important. And I think that's why it's so, like, it's so important to have different people with different lenses, because I don't think about fertility that much. And of course you do. And yes, diagnosable, treatable, important to screen, to preserve fertility, to not pass infection to your partners. And then syphilis that we were just talking about, also treatable and curable. And so most people who have syphilis will get a single shot of penicillin, or maybe up to three shots of penicillin. But again, really important to diagnose and to treat. And then we talked a little bit about herpes. And while herpes is not curable, it is, as you said earlier, treatable. And so we can treat people when they have outbreaks. And we can put patients on suppressive treatment so that they don't have outbreaks, and so that they don't have a risk of something transmitting it to their partners. And then we talked about HIV prevention. And as I said, there is also a lot of hope for patients who are living with HIV. We have such highly effective medications, but testing is really important. Not in the OBGYN world, of course, if you're pregnant, you get tested, but testing is really important if you don't ever encounter an OBGYN, just through your other sort of healthcare provider or doctor, because we want to detect infections so we can treat them. We estimate that about 1 in 7 people who are living with HIV don't know that they're living with HIV in the U.S. And so this is why testing, one of the many reasons why testing is so important.
Sure, sure. You know, I'm curious to hear your take on what you think are few, I don't know, maybe let's say three of the most important ways that you can prevent getting an infection.
Yes. Okay. So condom use consistently is probably the most tried and true, and probably the number one recommendation on everyone's list. I would say after that, being in a trying to put yourself in a situation or being in a situation, if possible, where you and your partner test frequently, especially if you both have multiple partners, and being able to be tested and treated in a sort of safe environment. And the third is then accessing preventive care. And so that's for patients at risk for HIV, getting on HIV preventive medications. I should actually mention that if folks are seeking HIV preventive medications, there's a site called Please Prep Me that people can go online, and you can find someone in your area who is familiar with prescribing HIV preventive medications. But I would say condom use, frequent testing, and engaging in preventive services are probably the three biggest ways to prevent infections. And then I would say just also know, as you said, that if you get an infection, it can be treated. So that fear shouldn't prevent you from getting tested.
Yeah. And I'd like to add one more thing on there is just communication, right? Communication,
yes,
with
absolutely.
Your partner, communication. And, you know, I know people that, you know, if they're exposed, will feel a lot of shame and guilt and, you know, carry that stigma and perhaps blame themselves and so forth. But I think it's important to, you know, definitely if you're having all those thoughts, you know, definitely speak with somebody, a therapist or somebody that can help you work through your thoughts and your feelings, but also make sure that you communicate. I'm sure, you know, it would be a difficult conversation to have with your partner, but make sure that you do try to have that conversation, because it is important to be forthright and, you know, let your partner know if you've been exposed or if that perhaps, you know, they were exposed and then gave it to you or whatever that case may be. But I think just communication is really, really important in any type of relationship.
I agree. And I think, you know, some of us, depending on the type of practice you have, will often help partners with disclosure to each other. And so that probably happens the most commonly in my practice with an HIV disclosure, if someone wants to tell a partner that they're living with HIV. But I've certainly done it for other STIs as well, because then you have a medical professional there who can answer questions. And so you don't go down that pathway of the what ifs that you can't get answered. The only other thing I would add to that is there are rarely circumstances in which disclosing an STI or HIV status may put the person who's disclosing in harm's way, either physically or emotionally. And
sure.
So that's the only thing that I always just do a quick check on that before
sure.
I sort of counsel sure. someone about disclosure.
Right, absolutely. If they're in an abusive relationship,
absolutely.
Or there might be some ramifications, sure, of course, that makes sense. So, you know, I know that, you know, your physician is never going to disclose your personal information to anyone else without your consent.
Absolutely.
And really, you know, we don't usually do that unless you want us to do that.
Exactly right. Yes, exactly right. That would be a disclosure visit when you ask us to help you, not without your permission.
Right.
Absolutely.
Exactly. So fantastic. So are there any other pearls you may want to leave our listeners and our viewers with, those that may be watching and concerned that they may have been exposed to a sexually transmitted infection or somebody living with one? Anything you'd love to say to them?
I would, yes, absolutely. I would say this. So I think we share a mission of kind of decreasing shame around talking about things that sometimes don't get talked about. And so there is no shame in asking for testing. There's no shame in having an STI. And there's no shame in asking for HIV prevention. Those are things that we as healthcare providers want to offer and want to know that you're interested in. And there, I think, are many people doing work in this space to try to make those services more accessible. And so I would just say, read online if you want to, listen to podcasts like this if you want to. You can find usually doctors who are kind of well-versed or comfortable with this subject matter, and then get tested and get the care that you need and deserve to live a really sort of worry, not, I don't know if worry-free is the right word, to live the life you want to live, basically.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's fantastic. And that is a great segue into, you know, how can people get in touch with you? Those that may, you know, really have enjoyed listening to you and they're like, gosh, you know, I really want to see her. How can they find you and get in touch with you?
Yeah, so the easiest way to get in touch with me is probably through my sexual health website. And so it's Charu, Charu, at sexquity.co. It's sexquity.co. You can drop me a message there. And I look forward to hearing from you.
It's amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I'm so grateful that you were on. And, you know, it's not that often that we get an infectious disease doctor to come on and talk about different sexually transmitted infections and what patients can do to help themselves and advocate for themselves and get tested. And, you know, so I really appreciate your time. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
And well, we are done here, and it's been real and really intimate. And remember, this is not meant to be any type of medical advice. So if you're having any issues or would like to be tested for any type of sexually transmitted infections, make sure you go visit your primary care doctor that can help you and help you get tested. And until next time, this is the Muslim Sex Podcast. So thank you for listening to the podcast, and make sure you leave us a review, share and like the podcast. And if you leave me a review, I'd love to shout you out on social media. So be sure that you share it with all your friends. And thanks for listening.